Hello and welcome to episode 25 of LDS Women's Book Review Podcast. I'm Shanda, here with my friends.
Hillary.
Sheila.
But we have a special guest with us here today. Go ahead and introduce yourself, special guest.
Well, I'm Angela Eschler. I'm an editor. I work with Covenant Communications, which is part of the Deseret Book family, for 7 years. And now I do freelance writing and editing, and I'm still working with Deseret Book and Covenant and individual authors and corporations and that sort of thing. So,
well, it's great to have you here with us. We can't wait to get to our in-depth discussion with you.
Yeah, I want to point out that we met Angela at the Whitney Awards. It was so exciting. She looked absolutely gorgeous.
Absolutely.
I was like, wow.
Looked, she still does. You should see
her
cute little getup.
Seriously.
Is this going to be edited out?
No, probably not.
We're leaving this in.
Don't worry. Nobody can see you blush. Does anyone have any personal news? We'll talk about that first.
Well, sure. No. I'm just going to apologize to our listeners, because not that it'll be much different than it has been in the past, but I won't be as well read over the next year because I've gone back to school.
Well, yeah. You're always apologizing to the listeners for something.
I know.
So, since there's no personal news, let's get right into book news. Sheila, have you come across anything new since
I've just been reading all of my fantasy books that I was telling you I was going to read? They all came in from the library.
Anything that you know of that's going to be released soon that we haven't talked about?
Oh boy, I didn't look at that
list.
Okay,
I
had that huge list.
What about you?
Nope, I haven't heard anything.
Okay, well, I have a little bit of book news. As far as Mr. James Dashner is concerned, author of the Jimmy Fincher series, The Door in the Woods, and The 13th Reality, I discovered on his blog that book number 2 in The 13th Reality series will be released in March of 2009.
Really?
That's when it's scheduled to be released.
Excellent.
So it's called The Hunt for Dark Infinity.
Sounds good.
So those of you who like The 13th Reality, and I'm doing what I can to get a copy for us so we can read it and review it in the next few months.
Well, in that vein, I guess I could say I did have exciting news. I got my AR copy of Far World.
Oh, you did? In the mail?
Yes. And I'm halfway through that. I'm just, you know me, you guys. I always have like 4, 5, 6 books that I'm reading at one time, novels. I'm not talking about kids' books, and I won't say anything about Far World yet until it's time.
Well, can you at least say if you're liking it?
Well, of course I like it. Jeff
Hello.
Wrote it.
Well, I know.
It's fantasy.
Can you give us a degree of liking?
You know, I think what he has done, it is going to be big. I think it's going to be a big thing for Jeff Savage. Yep, I honestly do.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Do I get to read it after?
Yeah, I'll let you borrow my copy.
Okay.
Sure.
I might even actually have
I think you need to. Because this is the first book out of a 5-book series. And this is going national.
Right.
I mean, this is a big thing.
But it is going national. And I really like Jeff and his writing, so I'm willing to sacrifice.
But the characters are so wonderful. I love the characters. I mean, you instantly bond with the main character.
Well, we know that Jeff and James Dashner are good friends. I know their style's not the same, so I'm interested in reading one of James Dashner's books since we've read some of Jeff's. And not only is book 2 coming out in March of 2009, but the paperback of book 1 is coming out then too. And you can
I see what you're saying.
The 13th Reality series. And you can find that blog at james-dashner.blogspot.com for those who are interested.
That's good. Well, and with the ARC that I got, the advanced reader's copy, I have to do a blog in July because I'm part of the blog tour. It's so exciting being part of the blog tour. So I will be doing a blog on our website looks very wonderful.
So watch for that.
Yes. So, and that won't be, but he's having so many people, the 400 people that did receive the advanced copies, that out of the 400 people, he's going to slowly, over the next 2 to 3 months, have them blog about the book.
Well, I think that's a great idea. Great marketing tactic.
Oh, I think he's just so smart. It's exciting. And he's so excited about it, too. You can just, if you go onto his websites and read his blogs, it's exciting.
Well, I can't blame him.
Fun to be part of it.
I hope it takes off for him big time.
I hope so, too. He deserves it.
He does. Yep.
All right. Any other book news? If not, we'll go right into recent reads.
Let's do recent reads.
Okay. You know what? I think we need to start with Angela on this one.
Yes, Angela.
Why don't you talk to us about books you've read, you know, personal books, not necessarily work-related books, but books do you get to read personal books?
I do. It's amazing. But I actually do. I read while I walk my dog. I hook his leash onto a belt that I wear, And then I read while I walk, so I can get in reading. And then I have audiobooks that I read while I clean and while I drive. And so I do try to get in, I don't know, I probably read like 4 or 5 books a week.
What?
Wow. Kate, okay, she kicks fanny, doesn't she, when it comes to the reading.
Well, I get to justify that, you know, it's my career, so I have to be keeping up with what's in the market, you know.
Good for you, though.
I really do need to become an editor.
Yeah, no kidding, Shannon.
Then I'll have an excuse, a real legitimate excuse,
right.
He wouldn't be able to say anything.
No, he wouldn't.
Yeah,
that he does anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That is the nice thing this morning, this afternoon, my husband was trying to watch TV in the basement. It's the only cool room. And I'm like, no, I have to work because I was reading The Host. So he went stomping upstairs to vacuum, which he needed to do anyway. But yeah, it's pretty fun to have to read for your job, so...
What books have you read, say, within the last couple weeks? Anything you'd like to mention on the podcast?
You know what? This book is, lots of people are reading this book, and I think there's a movie coming out with, what's her name, Bullock.
Sandra
Bullock. But Eat, Love, Pray by Elizabeth Gilbert. Has anyone read that?
No.
It's creative nonfiction, but it is a really good read. She's an incredible writer. It's got a little bit of swearing in it, and there's a romance at the end. I don't particularly think it was steamy or anything, but I'm not the biggest fan of romance, so I was kind of skipping it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the writing is incredible. The story is incredible. It's basically Elizabeth Gilbert.
Okay.
Basically it's true story, but she's a writer and her life kind of fell apart to a point. And so she decided that she just wanted to figure out how to be happy and find God. And so mm-hmm. she moved off to Italy to learn about happiness and pleasure and relaxing. And then she moved to India to just find God and learn how to meditate. And then she moved to Indonesia to learn all about balance and love. And it is a beautiful book. And it really, I was really surprised, but it taught me a lot about God's love for all of his children and God's mercy and how God just wants us to be happy. And it wasn't one of these sort of, it wasn't preachy and also wasn't, you know, overly silly, new agey, sappy. You know what I mean? It was really compelling, good soul-searching writing. And it just really moved me. And my book club just went crazy about it. They just talked and talked and talked and talked. So it really had a big impact. Another one that's really interesting is a book called Stumbling on Happiness. That is, it's a Harvard psychologist. And I'm trying to remember his name right now. I was just looking at it. But I think it's the only one with that title, and it's a white book with a bowl of cherries spilled over on it.
Yeah, I think I saw that one on Barnes & Noble or something recently.
And it is an excellent book. Everyone that I've lent it out to, I keep having to lend it out and lend it out and lend it out. It is absolutely fascinating. It's all about how our brains work and how our minds think and how basically why we'll plan what we want in the future and then we get there and it's not what we really want and we're all surprised by this. And it's full of just these fascinating experiments, and he's very funny and a very good writer. It's highly entertaining, and I had a friend that was reading it the other day, and she called me up really late at night. We have to talk about this part. So it's really another one that's been really fascinating.
You know,
with
nonfiction, it really does help when it's entertaining.
Yes.
I agree.
And he is funny. He's a good writer, too. These are all, like, excellent writing. And then just for a couple quick fiction, if nobody's read Starcross or Larklight by Philip Reeve. I think they might be technically middle grade or YA because the characters are younger, but it is so funny for adults.
What are the names again?
Yeah.
It's Larklight.
Okay, and Starcross.
And Starcross is the second book in the series. It's by Philip Reeve.
Philip Reeve.
And it's basically a space opera. It's
Really? How fun.
It's really fun. It's Victorian England, but
love
it's space pirates and space bad guys.
See, I would absolutely love
totally
this.
That's totally up my alley.
I know. Shanda and I are just going, yep, this would be good for us.
If it involves space, I'm there.
And
you
I'm
would
over
love
here
it.
Going, oh, no.
Yeah. No, and you know what? It is really hilarious. It is some of the best voice I have read in years.
I'm there.
Yeah, me too.
And my husband and I have extremely disparate tastes in books, and it's his favorite new series, too. So that should say something.
Okay, well, I'll mark that on my list.
I'm putting a star by that one, too.
I have a huge list, so why don't you guys go ahead, and if we want to talk about other things.
Do you have one more fiction?
This one was kind of big a while ago, but The Poisonwood Bible.
I've heard of it.
Have you guys read that?
I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
If you haven't read The Poisonwood Bible or The Secret Life of Bees, Those two were kind of, they had their day in the sun, you know.
I tried to read The Secret Life of Bees, and I started in the first two or three chapters of it, and then I just kind of, I don't remember if I ran out of time or if it just fizzled for me. I don't remember which it was, but I didn't finish it.
It's a really different book. Yeah. It's kind of about female divinity, and I don't know, it's really interesting. So if you have time, try it out. She's one of my favorite authors just because she's brilliant with language. Mm. But Poisonwood Bible, it's about the Congo in the 60s. And it's about this family of girls who moved there with their kind of domineering father. And it's a really fascinating story about history and about women and about finding yourself and about God, and just beautifully written.
Do any of these have swearing or questionable content?
You know what? So far, I'm not all the way through Poisonwood Bible. So far, it has the D word and the H word, and not very often because the father's a preacher. So they get in trouble if they say it.
There you go.
And
so
I
can't vouch for the entire book.
I can't vouch for the entire book, but I'm guessing. I'm sure you could look it up online on a million different sites and blogs what's in it. And same thing with
Secret
Life of Bees. You know, same thing, that's pretty actually clean because it's set in the 1960s and the main character's a young girl, and I don't think there's much in there that's questionable either. So
this particular book, everyone has been telling me that I have to read those. Mm-hmm. And you want to tell us a little bit about
Thousand them? Splendid Sons and The Kite Runner?
Uh-huh. I've had several people tell me about those.
The Kite Runner is an excellent, excellent book. A Thousand Splendid Sons is at my house right now. My husband and I are fighting over who gets to read it first.
I love it.
And The Kite Runner is the first book he did. It is a beautiful book. It's basically about redemption. It's about growing up. It's also about history and wars and political and cultural things. But it's about growing up and finding yourself, and about loyalties and about regret and forgiveness. And it does have a scene in there that is extremely disturbing. In fact, my husband couldn't finish it because it has a sodomy rape scene in it, which sounds really horrible, and it kind of is, but it wasn't explicit, but it was so well written that it was very disturbing. And it is obviously
like emotionally disturbing.
Very emotionally disturbing. So if you can maybe sort of skip that scene, but it's kind of the crux of the book is the witness of this scene. That's what the regret and the self-hatred and the distress is about for the rest of his life, that he has to come to terms with and try to go redeem because it was his best friend of another race, and he didn't stand up for his best friend. And so it's a really, it's very emotionally disturbing, but also, I mean,
kind of the basis of the book.
It's kind of the basis of the book. And I mean, that's what so many things in life are about, are disturbing,
unpleasant,
sad, unpleasant things and overcoming them and rising above. And so it's definitely a triumph of the human spirit type of story, but very realistic. And, you know, it doesn't have like a sappy, perfect ending, but it's also very engaging and suspenseful. And the author? And the other, I'm trying to remember his name.
I could not remember either, even though I had people recommending this book to me.
I think most people have heard of these books.
Yeah.
So, and it'll be very easy to find them. Any librarian would.
Right. Extremely easy. Right. And they are making a movie of that as well.
The Kite Runner?
Yes.
Wow.
And I didn't know that.
A Thousand Splendid Sons has also gotten rave reviews from everyone. And it's about two wives of the same man, also in the Middle East again, and kind of their life of oppression, but how they come to love each other and rely on each other and their trials and struggles and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that one sounds interesting to me. I think I read a little summary of it on the internet a couple months back, and it was really, I don't know, it sounded very intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of nice sometimes to get a glimpse of life and what life is like in another part of the mm-hmm. world or even another decade.
Right. Kite Runner, extremely intriguing in terms of ways of thinking and places you've never been and, you know, just worldviews that you've never been exposed to. That's what I really like about his books. So
I think it's good to do that. It's good to read about
sometimes it's nice
outside of
mind.
Utah
mm-hmm. yes.
or outside right. of our religion or outside of just our political way of thinking,
right.
Republican and Democrat, go somewhere else. And
stuff that you'd never even experience in your life, you know, countries
exactly.
you may not ever get to.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds
okay,
good.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Sheila, you have some books you've been able to read recently since you're out of preschool now?
Well, I've been substitute
well,
teaching.
That's right.
But what's really been great, though, is that when I'm teaching the upper grades, I always have like 40 minutes of silent reading time at the beginning of school. So I bring my books along
that's
with
great.
Me, and it's really cool because I'm reading the books they're reading because they're all into the same type of fantasy books that I love, you know. So when I'm sitting there reading my copy of Fablehaven 3, then they're all doing it. And then we have this really nice discussion with the kids. So, but I did finish Fablehaven 3, and honestly, it is fabulous.
Better than book two?
Oh, yeah. And I've kind of been doing a little poll of kids between the ages of 10, between 10 and 17, because a lot of my nieces and nephews have been reading it too, and they all agree. Fablehaven 3 is just awesome. His writing is just wonderful. It's gotten so much better. I mean, the storyline.
Well, I remember how you raved about off.
I know.
First Fablehaven.
I've loved all of them.
Brandon Moles pulled it off again.
Oh, more than pulled it off with this one. And
I really need to get into
this. Oh, it is so easy. Well, and I read on his website that he sold the movie rights, or they've been, however they buy the movie rights for Fablehaven and also for Candy Shop Wars. So,
really?
Yeah, so for both of those books.
I think Candy Shop Wars would make an excellent movie. Now, I don't think I really liked the book that much, the actual story.
But I loved it.
But I can see it visually.
It will be a wonderful
really
movie.
Really working well.
So I'm excited really about that. Well, and the good thing I was going to tell you guys about Fablehaven 3, it doesn't all just take place in one spot like the other two did. You go off in two different, I really don't want to say what happens. It doesn't just take place right in Fablehaven. There's another place that they go to. Or some of the people go to. And that's what I really liked about it, the variety. And he brought in all of these new characters and new people. And the ending was just totally explosive.
Was that the last book or is there
No, there's two more books.
Okay. I thought there was
five. Yeah, there is five books in the series. I was so thrilled. It's like, yeah.
Okay, so anything else besides Fablehaven 3?
Well, I read Dragonflight, which is the second book after Dragon Slippers, Jessica Day George. I loved it. I really liked it.
Did you like it more than Dragon Slippers?
You know what? They are two totally different books. Even though they have the same characters, two different things are going on in both books, you know? And I was pleasantly surprised because, you know, a lot of times with series, whether it's Fablehaven, a series like Harry Potter, I think it's hard to come up with new ideas to keep the characters busy doing something different than they normally did in the other book. And with Dragonflight, it was amazing how she took the same characters but just broadened them and made them more, even more likable.
To get to know the dragons better?
Yes, in a way. And there's a lot of new dragons that are introduced. But really? I think our talk next month with Jessica.
Does Shardis get his windows
back? Is going, well, I can't say that. But, you are going to be. You're really going to be pleasantly surprised. I mean, okay. I really liked it. And then
do you still have it or did you take it back?
Well, I got it from the library and I'm ordering my copies.
I have a copy. We just read it for our book group.
Well, I'm going to buy it anyway because I have Dragon Slippers.
Right.
But I just wondered if you had it with you, right? Like, if you have it in your possession.
No, I got it. But like I said,
I'm kind of excited to read it.
I'm buying all of her books so she can sign them when she comes, but I just want them in my collection. They're just good. Did you like Dragonflight?
Yes.
I really enjoyed it.
In fact, I need to email her about that because we're in a book group and together and we read her book, which I'm really bummed I wasn't there because my deadlines were out of control.
Oh, no.
But I really want to know how that was for her as an author being in the book group where your book was being discussed.
That would be so wild.
Hey, we'll
I don't
ask,
know how.
You'll have to ask her.
We
so
will.
I'll know.
We will. We'll have to ask her that. Yeah. But I just felt like with Dragonflight, she just, like I said, it was the same characters, but totally different feel and story and just everything. I think that's why I enjoyed it so much.
Was Krill just as fiery and likable?
Oh, and she's more fiery in this one.
Really?
It's almost like watching a little girl. She was a little girl in the first one, but she's a woman in the second one. That's kind of the way I looked at it. You know?
I'm going to have to read that.
But the other book I want you guys to try and read before Jessica comes is Sun and Moon, Ice and Snow.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
It's on my list. I love that fairy tale, though, so I'm curious what she
One of my favorite fairy tales. Well, and I have a friend that had read East, which is another version of that same fairy tale. And I'm trying to convince her to read Sun and Moon, Ice and Snow. I said, I can assure you, I haven't read East, so I want to read East just to compare the two. But that's still my favorite. I know that's really funny. I love the dragons, but I absolutely loved that story.
Well, and if you think about it, most of the fairy tales we have are just our version. Like my husband just taught us Cinderella. What do you call that? You guys are teachers.
The unit.
Section unit.
Right.
At his junior high. And actually the Cinderella story, so they had to read a whole bunch of different versions of the Cinderella story from all kinds of different cultures. And the one that actually made sense to me was where they do foot binding. And all of a sudden the part about the shoes and the not fitting, I'm like, well, that suddenly makes sense in the context of that culture. But in the context of America, we don't walk around seeing how, you know,
no, we don't.
Graceful our feet are.
Well, not only that, but if the shoe is cute, we will.
Right.
Yes, we will.
Exactly. So it was really interesting to me to think what versions of our fairy tales are just the ones that we happen to take down. I mean, I know that Hans Christian Andersen, or not Hans Christian, wait.
Yeah, you're right.
The brothers. What are the brothers?
Brothers Grimm.
He says yes.
Right.
They actually, the myth is that they went all over the countryside gathering all of these fairy tales from all the folk, and they actually got a very large majority of them from a bunch of educated women that were in their social circle, which, of course, educated women weren't writing and weren't, you know,
They were able to do that, yes. They just told the stories.
But the marketing at the time was that they had gone to all of these folks, and, you know, and so it's kind of interesting to think of where all these come from and all the different, you know, factors that go into the version of our fairy tale. So I actually love retellings for the same reason, because it's just taking the universal truths or concepts in them and making them relevant again.
Well, didn't you, and wasn't your friend Julie?
Yes.
The one, she was the one that had come across an author or a few authors who had rewritten, like, Princess and the Pea and things like that.
And I started reading one of those, but my book was due at the library, so I had to take it back. I only got through about 4 chapters of Before Midnight, a retelling of Cinderella. And I was liking it, and it's like, oh, no, and I couldn't renew it because it was requested. So.
Did you ever get to that?
Yes, I did try reading, and I can't remember now. I can see the cover, and I cannot remember which one it was. I can just tell you that I wasn't terribly fond of it.
Really?
But I'm not into that. It's not
the fairy tales.
It's fantasy, fun, you know, and retelling. I mean, I do enjoy, don't get me wrong, I enjoy my good Cinderella stuff. I do. Ever After is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, I love that movie.
But as far as this version of it, I wasn't as crazy about it.
And then the last thing, I'm still in the process of reading Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson. And you know what? My nieces and nephews, they totally love these books. When I told them that I had met him at the Whitney Awards, they thought that was just so cool. Now, with Mistborn, he really gets into a lot of detail. And so it was really hard to get into it at first. But once I got past a certain point, it's been really good. And I mean, you look at his pages of his book. I mean, if it was a page like this, there's twice as many words on one page. But yeah, it's a good story, and I'm really like, you will like it. I can tell you that you will probably and I know that your husband would listening to it.
My husband Bruce loves them, and so does a few other editors I know. Actually,
did you get through all your list?
Yeah, I think that is it. I think that's it.
How about you, Hill?
Shanda issued me a solo challenge. Apparently.
There is a story behind this. Hillary, well, she's a hard read when it comes to fiction.
Yes, I am.
In other words, she doesn't like a lot of what we read.
She is very, very picky.
I know. Well, in an evening of a little bit of frustration with my lovely best friend here, I decided that she needed to find her own fiction. Not any authors we discussed before, not LDS fiction either. It had to be a work of fiction that she really liked, that she discovered on her own, and something that she would recommend to the rest sincerely, not just to get out of the challenge, but to really mean it. And I told her, you know, sometime in the next couple of months.
You said a month.
No,
you
said...
You gave me a month.
No.
Because I was panicking 2 weeks ago.
I said in the next podcast or the next one.
Oh, whatever.
I did. And so, because I was a little bit, I don't know, fed up with her being so hard on the fiction that we would come across sometimes. So that's the history behind it.
Anyway, so, okay, so I did. I kind of did it in a roundabout sort of way, because I was going to go to the library and talk to the librarian, but that takes a lot of time and I'm a little bit short on that. So I did it the speedy, cheaty way, which was skimming through a scrapbook magazine, and one of the pages happened to be this woman's book list.
I love it.
And I went through and I went, and I wrote down about 5 or 6 of them that I've never heard of, because of course there were like 3 or 4 that I've heard of. So these are the ones I chose. And you guys might have heard of this. It's called A Northern Light. And this was actually on Oprah's book list by Jennifer Donnelly. Have you read it, Angela?
You know, I have not read that one, but I've heard it all over the place, so.
Yeah, it's apparently gotten quite a bit. I had to really hunt this thing down. I was really surprised. I just started it. I'm only like 2.5 chapters into it, and I stopped because I wanted to get started on the second one too, but I actually really like it. It's got another strong, both of these books that I chose have very strong female characters. I love that. I love a good strong female character. I'll kind of give you an idea. I'll read you the inside cover of A Northern Light, because I'm not far enough into it to really say you got to read this. Although I must say at this point, I really like it. But you do have to be aware that there is swearing in it. I'll just tell you the inside cover here. Her name is Maddie, which of course I like because that's one of my daughter's names. She has a word for everything. And what she does is every day, every chapter is a new word. Like she picks a word out of the dictionary and that's her word for the chapter. And then the chapter kind of follows along that word.
I
so it's really
love
cool.
That. So it's kind of cute. Fun
yeah.
thing to do.
It's totally different. Never seen that before. She collects words, stores them up as a way of fending off the hard truths of her life, the truths that she can't write down in stories. The fresh pain of her mother's death, the burden of raising her sisters while her father struggles over his broke back farm, the mad welter of feelings she has for the handsome but dull, and he is dull, Royal Loomis, who says he wants to marry her, and the secret dream that keeps her going, finishing high school, attending college in New York City, and becoming a writer. This takes place in like 1930-something on like a farm
nice
in the...
frame.
Oh, 1906, like sorry. It was
further, even earlier.
Even earlier.
Before World War I. That's great.
I didn't even notice. I knew it was a while ago. A long, long while ago.
Turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
And then what happens is she gets... She wasn't supposed to, but she ended up being able to work at this resort not too far from her house. She really, really wanted to do it so she could earn money so she could go to New York. But her dad, since her mother died, really... She's basically taken over the role of mother for the family. And she's really young. She's only like, I think she's 15 or 16, so she's not very old. And she ends up going to this resort where... The drowned body of a young woman turns up at the hotel where Maddie works, and all her words prove useless. But in the dead woman's desperate love letters, Maddie again finds her voice and a strength and determination to live her own life because she's really tied in with her family, like her dad especially. And then this is a hard time. This is like her neighbors. They're feeding a couple of the neighbor kids because the mother has like it's either 6 or 12. A lot of children, and she's single, but
it's
she's
six,
got
12.
Mental. I mean, after six, come on.
You don't know who he's there or not. Yeah.
She can't take, she mentally cannot take care of her children. And she like, she'll, the boy, well, his name's Tommy. He'll come and have dinner with them. And dinner is like cornmeal and turnips kind of a thing. It's like nothing, but he has literally nothing to eat at home because his mother is, she works, but she drinks off her paycheck because she's so stressed with life and mentally not quite all there. And yet she has these little ones and that's kind of hard for me to, well, no, I mean like really not all there.
Some days and I don't feel like I'm mentally
so
all
it's
there.
Kind of hard. It's kind of sad, but you know that that happened in that time frame, especially like, and especially when you started getting into the depression into the 30s and stuff, it was really bad then. But,
yes.
But it, you can see how hard life was for these people early on. So it's a really good book. Just watch out. There is swearing by the older sister. The next book I read, oh, and aside from reading a lot of Memoir Structure of Anatomy and Physiology this month, and Introduction to Massage Therapy, which I've had to read chapters on, I read, it's called Goose Chase, not The Goose Chase, but Goose Chase by Patrice Kendall. And this one's been getting a lot of buzz, too. On this list, the gal read it in their book club, and she didn't like it, but yeah, quite frankly, I do. I think it's pretty cute. It's actually really cute. It's about this girl. Her name is Alexandria Aurora Fortunato. And this is the inside cover, and she is lovely as the dawn, but that is only one of her problems. There's also the matter of those three magical gifts of treasure bestowed on her by a mysterious old woman. King Claudio the Cruel wants to marry her for her beauty and her wealth, and so does his rival, Prince Edmund of Dorlo. That's two more problems. And he's like, the prince is just the biggest dork. I mean, but he's cute, but he's only like 15. She's like 13, 14, 14, 15, and he's like 15, 16, so... It's understandable.
Yes,
come on.
We all understand
but,
that.
And then worst of all, she's locked up in a tower with a grill of iron bars and several hundred tons of stone between her and her freedom. Some days Alexandria wishes she looked like a pickled onion. Clearly the only thing to do is to escape, and that's what Alexandria does, aided by her 12 darling goose companions. And it's adorable, you guys. I mean, the first chapter... Okay, I like a book that starts out like this. Chapter 1. The king killed my canary today.
Hello. Perfect.
That's the first opening line.
Kind of like it was my aunt's idea.
Oh,
with
the dragon
slippers.
Right?
Yes.
Yep,
that, like,
same
dragon slippers.
In fact,
yep.
When I started reading this, my first thought was dragon slippers. It's totally not even close to the same storyline, but it's enough. It's it for me because I don't read a lot of science fiction fantasy, if any, really. That it was very similar, and I could see comparisons, but completely different all at the same time. And then this is cute because the next line, now I know full well that the customary way to begin such a tale as mine is once upon a time when wishes still came true, there lived a poor orphan goose girl. or some such fiddle faddle, but what do I care for custom? 'Tis my own story, and I am telling it, and I will tell it as I please. I like her already.
See, I liked her from the get-go. That would grab me instantly also.
And basically, she is orphaned. Her mother dies. Her father died a long time ago, and her mother died when she was like 10 or 11, and she left her in this little cute little cottage in this country and left her with these 12 geese. And her mother says on her deathbed, take good care of the geese. Don't kill them. Don't eat them, whatever. You know, just take really good care of the geese. They will help you. They'll protect you. And she's like, okay, yeah, whatever. But she does. She does out of respect for her mother. She takes care of these geese. And an old beggar lady comes by one day, and she's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, so it's not like, I mean, she can hear or see someone coming, and her geese, if you know much about geese, they're like watchdogs. You don't mess with geese. They usually cackle or scare away people or whatever they need to do. But this old beggar lady literally sneaks up on her, and she is hungry and thirsty. So I'm going to call her the Goose Girl, because that's what they call her through the whole book. They never call her Alexandria until like four chapters into it.
Have read it's the like, Goose Ugh. Girl. It's like,
but yeah, and so she feeds this, and she calls her an old hag. This old hag, and she gives her three gifts, and one is absolutely beautiful. That's why the opening line. She's as beautiful as the dawn. Well, she's beautiful. She's given the gift of this amazing hair, and it's amazing hair, really. I would love that hair. It'd be awesome. But it, every morning when she brushes it, it dispels gold dust. So it makes her very wealthy. And then the second gift, so the third gift, so beauty and then this gold dust in her hair. And then the third gift is every time she cries diamonds. So it's made her very wealthy, which is why the king is interested in her, because they find out about it, because in order to survive, she goes and sells her diamonds and sprinkles her gold dust and buys things so that she has what she needs. And the prince come to find out, he's not as stupid as I thought he was at first. I mean, she's written him pretty well, because he's not so bad. And I'm curious to see where it's going to go. I'm 3/4 of the way done. So, and I started it yesterday afternoon. So it's pretty good. It's called Goose Chase, and it's Patrice Kendall. And I know you'll like it.
I can tell you already. I want to read it.
I know you're going to like it. I'm not even worried about that one.
Patrice.
So Kendall, K-I-N-D-L. So, okay. And it's cute. And I actually, and for a book that I probably would normally never choose on my own, like go and pick it, I was pleasantly surprised. So
that's great.
Really I'm good impressed. Book. And it's very cute. It's very cute. I just love this girl. She reminds me a lot of Creel. And maybe that's why I like it so much.
Probably.
Because she reminds me of Dragon Slipper. So
I've only managed to get some of one book read since last time. It was a book that I saw recommended on LDS Fiction Readers, the Yahoo group. And it's called Madigan's Fantasia by Margaret Mahey. I think that's M-A-H-Y. It's about... It's futuristic.
Ooh, I like that too.
The thing is, it's not futuristic.
It's not science fiction type.
No, no, no. What it is this girl, Garland Madigan, is part of Madigan's Fantasia, which is like a traveling circus group.
Oh.
Only they call them a Fantasia. They do magic and tricks and things like that. But they live in a post-apocalyptic time.
Oh, those are
where
some good
they
stories.
Call it the destruction, where yes. bombs were dropped and everything.
Yes.
And they are in what they call the age of remaking, the remaking. And she's 12, and she's an act. She does the tightrope act. And her father is the one that was in charge of the Fantasia. And then he ends up, you know, something happens, and they have to make their way through old roads that are always changing. And I'm only... 1/4 of the way through it, but I haven't had a whole lot of time to read it, but it's caught my interest so far because these two boys and a baby come through time from the future.
Time travel, yay!
And their names are Timon
and Eden. I have
this
thing for time
Eden.
Travel, I don't know.
Well, and it's interesting because I don't quite know if I would say, you know, absolutely read this book, but it's definitely different. It's different than anything I've read.
Okay, so what is compelling you to read this? I mean, just what is the thing in the book that is making you want to pick up that book and keep reading?
Because I haven't read anything like it before.
Okay, I like
it's,
that.
You know, these guys that's are gypsies reason. And they travel through, and she's 12, but she's...
That's
yeah, but...
It is interesting.
But they, I mean, they have oil, and they have motorized things, but they don't have...
This must have been written before gas prices went up.
Yeah, I about had a heart attack filling up my minivan the other day. $58.
Oh, like, that's true.
72 for mine, and it's a minivan, too.
Wow. How big is your tank?
21 gallons.
It's like
was it almost dry? Yeah. Anyway, so they go around, they do tricks, and in this world, this post-apocalyptic world where they're trying to remake themselves in the world, they are actually, they can get a lot of things and go a lot of places, because in this drab, difficult, dangerous world, they like to have the excitement and the magic and that. In the future town of Solus, which is a big town,
right?
Timon and Eden and their little sister Jewel come through time from the future Solus, because there's an evil leader who's trying to get any kind and every kind of power in his possession. And something happens in Garland's time that they're trying to stop, because they think that will stop the Ninog from coming in power.
Well, I think it's fascinating that it's the children that are coming back to change things,
and
not
two guys. Well, they have two men.
That's true.
I haven't seen that one. They have two men that are after them, and they know they are. And Madigan's Fantasia knows they are, but they've taken Timon and Eden and Jewel into their little Fantasia, so they are protecting them. And I'm interested to see how it goes, because she writes in this diary that she found, you know, she has a pencil and paper, and she just has this feeling that someone's on the other side of the pages. Well, these boys that came back, they actually have a very ancient copy of that diary.
No way.
As they read it, and when they came back, the words started changing. Sometimes it'll disappear, sometimes it'll be there. And
How clever is this? The ending kind of changes. This is great.
So it's very interesting. And Timon has just told Garland about and showed her the journal. And she ran off because she doesn't know what to think of it. It really upset her. So
you see Sheila's little wheel. I can almost see your little wheels. Going, I can see it. There's a little squirrel.
I know. It's just interesting. I'm, like I said, I'm not very far into it, but it's got my attention.
You've got my attention also.
I want to see how it goes.
When there's some different twist, some different way of, you know, of writing the story. I mean, I love the idea about that journal. You know, I love the idea about
that's
them.
That's cute.
I know.
Yeah, that almost reminds me a little bit of Harry Potter. A little bit.
With the diary?
Yeah, a little bit.
I guess I don't remember that. Okay. I'm way out of it on
Harry
Potter.
Well, so am I.
I haven't seen any movies. It's just been so long I've forgotten.
In fact, I'm reading through them again with my daughters. Started reading all the Harry Potter books now, and so I'm reading them again.
Any excuse, for heaven's sake.
There's two movie sevens. They're gonna be making part one and part two now.
Oh my goodness gracious. Okay. Anyway, now that we've talked about our recent reads, because really that's all I've read.
I love this cover. This is a great cover.
It looks almost angelic.
They look elf. It's an elf. Those are elf ears.
Really? It's just really interesting because they have like map readers that are specifically for reading the maps, because the worlds can change and they're not always where they're supposed to be. And it makes me wonder if the world's just always changing.
I like that.
And so I haven't got into it enough to really know the detail and stuff, but I really need to see how Garland plays into all of this. But
this will be very interesting.
Now, before we get into our big discussion, I did want to mention that I had the privilege of reading Dorothy Kennington's one of her submission copies of The Fairy Thorn, her book that she has recently written and is trying to get published, and I will definitely say that it was pure Dorothy Kennington from beginning to end. Very good story. It does, if I remember correctly, cross oceans or goes into different countries, if I can remember correctly. I may be wrong because I read it really fast because I was just eating up the whole thing. I was so happy to be reading new Dorothy Kennington material. I was in heaven. My husband was out of town, and I just sat there reading almost all night. It was great. But I loved it, and it was great. I was so lucky to be able to get a copy of it from her daughter-in-law to be able to read. It was just in a binder, you know, just single-sided pages. I'm sure Angela knows what that's all about. And I couldn't believe how fast I was able to flip through those pages, but definitely, definitely Dorothy Kennington all the way. Mystery, suspense, romance.
Shut up.
Yeah.
You're making her feel bad.
So anyway, I hope that someone snatches that up quick and that they do a reprinting of her books, because I think that a publisher could make a lot of money doing something like that. I know we have a lot of people asking for Dorothy Kennington's books, so I'd buy the whole set all over again, even though I already have them all.
I know.
I'd buy a whole set.
And I would still buy the whole set again.
Yep.
Mine are so worn out, I can't even begin to tell you.
Well, I'm going to need them for my girls. I want them to read them as soon as they get old enough to appreciate it, you know?
Yep, that's true. Me too.
So I'd even buy a couple copies just because. The ones my girls can read and the ones for me.
That's right. No. I'm the same way.
Now that we've finished talking about recent reads, let's get into our discussion.
Yes.
Now, Angela, what do you want to do first? Do you want to start off the discussion and we can go right into what you want to talk about with editing and
no pressure.
Whatever. Or do you, or would you like to discuss a little bit of the host first?
We could discuss the host. You could ask questions. I don't have like a speech plan.
No, that's fine.
So
just what do you feel comfortable with right now?
I'm comfortable discussing either if you want to talk about the host in the context of books and editing.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's kind of do both. That sounds
good. I like that idea.
Okay, well, why don't you start off?
Okay, well, from an editorial perspective, and this is just speaking for myself.
Yes, by the way, this whole thing is her personal opinion.
Right.
There's no
I'm not
affiliation
speaking for any other editors, particularly Christian or... I actually am enjoying the host so far. From an editorial perspective, I think the thing that Stephanie Myers has going for her more than anything is her fresh twist on everything.
Amen.
Yes.
I think what editors look for the most is something fresh. That can be a fresh voice in the writing style. It could be a fresh idea. We were just talking about Stephanie Black's The Believer, just a really cool new idea, concept, like this Madigan's Fantasia. Just a new world that hasn't been, you know, we haven't read about before, but basically something fresh. And then they're also always looking for something they can sell. And sometimes something they can sell is not necessarily something that they love, but they know that their market loves it. And it's great when you can get both. And vampires have been big. Romance, of course, is always big.
Always.
I mean, you know, Anne Rice, vampires were huge. And the fact that she made it this sweet little teen romance with vampires and murdering and killing. And, you know, it's a very fresh new little voice about a young girl who wants to become a vampire instead of the always afraid of, you know, becoming the undead.
Well, and the nice thing about the way she's done it is it's not just about the story, but it's about the humanity behind the story. What would she be giving up?
Right, right.
Kind of a little, like you said, a fresh twist, but I think that's the main reason why. Well, the chemistry too, but
I think the chemistry is huge for the female reader.
Yeah. But you know, for the adult, as far as the more intellectual reader, I know some of them may be shying away from it. But as an intellectual reader myself, I appreciate a certain level of intelligence in a book. And while it may not necessarily be an highly intelligent book. No, I don't know. Don't take that the wrong way, because
it's not literary.
It's not a dumb book.
It's not literary.
Right. But there is, for the intellectual reader, there are questions to be asked that can create good discussion.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. That's you like books that make you think about farther, you know, outside of your normal things you normally think about.
You can take it however
you
want.
That's the way
you
I like it.
You can take it as a simple romance, as a good story.
If that's all you're looking for, that's all you'll get. Right.
But if you want something a little deeper, you can find it.
Well, and that's what I loved about the host. There's a lot
of deep took over your
thinking ideas in the host. I mean, seriously, once you get, especially near the end, boy, you're thinking, I mean, because the main characters, there's a lot going on. I don't want to say what
well,
it
you're
is.
But because you're torn. Like, this isn't someone who should be your best friend, but you can't help but like this person. But
right.
What this person is doing and what they represent, you don't like.
Did you guys already summarize the basic premise last time, so readers can
we
know?
Really didn't. Really. We really didn't say as much about it because we didn't want to give a lot away about what happened. So we really didn't talk a lot about the characters or about really what happened near
or
the
plot
end.
Line.
Yeah, we really didn't get into it as much.
Okay, because I was going to say, I don't know if you want to cover just what's on the back liner or...
Well, why don't you kind of give a summary from an editor's point of view?
Just a really short, not giving anything away summary, but basically there's an alien invasion.
It's a subtle one.
A subtle alien, a non-violent, peaceful alien invasion where they don't believe in being wasteful and they want to non-violently take over their host bodies. And basically there's I guess the alien's a female. Is the alien a female?
Yes.
So the alien's a female, I guess. And the girl whose body she gets to inhabit, they are kind of warring for who gets to keep possession of the body. And so that is, again, the new twist in this, is that the aliens are the peaceful. They look on humans as the super violent and the dark
we
and
have
evil.
The guns
and so it's like this super, super peaceful alien society. And you don't know if the good guy is the alien or if the good guy is the resistance humans. I mean, you're thinking it's the humans at the beginning because you're human. But as you get along, you start to really like some of the characters and see their viewpoints. Right. And that is the fun thing about it is she gives a twist on how you think about your world.
Though she does throw in the bad guy alien.
Yes, she does.
And I haven't gotten far enough to know if there's bad guy humans, like how far she takes this game of
playing
opposites.
There are, in a sense. And it's hard to explain why,
well,
but there
basic
are.
Basic humanity. There are generally good people, and there are some people who would not handle a certain situation the best way.
And that is exactly what happens.
Right.
But this whole scenario that you're describing just continues, plays itself out throughout the whole book.
Right. The what is good, what is evil, what's light, what's dark, how do you define those things? Challenging your standard basics.
This book does take the intellectual reading I was just talking about to a whole nother level.
Yes, it does.
And it's something that I think that if a person gives it a chance, almost anyone could like this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the writing style is very different from I don't know. This is how I was feeling.
I think
totally
her writing
different.
Style has become more complicated, too.
Much better.
Well, I just, you know how you were mentioning the nonviolent possessing of the bodies and how they view themselves as nonviolent and healing
this violent, horrible culture.
Right, yeah, fixing it, whatever, only they're not going to give it back. And that's the thing that gets me, is that, you know, they want to come in and make the most of this or whatever, but that's how they live, moving from different hosts and different planets and different worlds. And she's Wanderer, who's the main alien character.
Right.
She has been on, 9 planets? 9 worlds? Something like that. Mm-hmm. This is the 9th one, and she decides she wants to stay. But, you know, you can't help but end up liking her.
Mm-hmm. I liked her.
The one thing that this book did prove to me is that there is a nonviolent way to be violent.
Oh, definitely.
Because invasion in any way
colonization
is a form of violence. You know, I mean, it mentions in one world, one forest of sea plants or something just did not want to be possessed, and so they allowed themselves to die. You know, and that in itself, I mean,
that just seems so sad to me when I read that.
I don't know.
I mean, it's
but,
just all these
but I can
living
understand it, you know?
Things
absolutely.
That died.
But well, it kind of gives you an appreciation for the human spirit, that how you can triumph in certain situations and the different strengths of, you know, some people are stronger than others.
And what's worth fighting for, too?
Personalities, whatever.
That was, I thought, what is worth fighting for?
And is the violent tendencies of humans by nature something to be fully abhorred or just managed but appreciated but managed? You know, like accepted as, yes, sometimes we have that violent nature, but it does need to be managed. And bridled, I guess you could say.
Well, there's the capacity that's within all of us as humans.
Mm-hmm. And is that bridling of it and controlling it and getting past that where the growth really happens, and could an alien race cure that, or is that something that as a human being?
But they weren't trying to cure it.
They were trying to fix it. You know, like they wanted to get rid of the violence and make the world reach its full potential. And I think, can a world really meet its full potential when it's not even its original people?
You know, that there's so many ways to look at the story. I mean, you could look at the story as a classic colonization story. There's been intellectual colonizations when you disagree with people and don't respect their worldviews or their differences. That's even a way of colonizing, you know, that it's that concept of, like with the suicide of the tree plants in this story, you know, Masada. I mean, there's thousands of examples from history of where a people who believe so strongly in their own worldviews and ways of doing things that they think are sacred or important are willing to end their lives rather than trade that sacred, important thing over to the quote unquote heathens or Gentiles or however you see the other. And that's what I think is really interesting about this book is you could say it's a political parable. You could say it's not. Mm-hmm. You could say it's just about personal ways of not being open-minded outside of your worldviews. I mean, there's so many ways you can look at what she's talking about in the story.
Or you could even just take it as a good sci-fi story.
Yeah, good adventure romance.
You know, I think that's one of her talents.
Romance. Weird romance, but that's fun, right?
It's different.
It's definitely different.
I think I really loved it because there were two very strong women. I love books where the women are strong.
Well, and Wanderer really doesn't start out very strong.
She doesn't, but she does gain that strength throughout
and
the book.
I beg the question then, is it because of Melanie or is it because she develops her as a person, so to speak, on her own?
Excellent question.
Right.
I think she gained strength from Melanie.
The whole thing.
Well, was it Melanie or was it the feelings Melanie was expressing? Because as a person, Melanie herself, yes, she was strong, but I personally didn't care for Melanie.
I have to agree with you there. She was not my favorite.
I liked Melanie.
I loved Wanderer. You cannot like a character but still appreciate, you know. And I appreciate the role she played, but her feelings for Jared, thank you, were the catalyst for the whole story, basically.
That's true.
It wasn't Melanie herself.
It was Melanie just a flatter character. Like, she was just a foil for the alien, basically. Is that kind of... Yes. I haven't gotten far enough to know if Melanie
gets
more developed.
That's kind of how I felt about it, because it was really about... She was the supportive character. She'd be like... She'd get the award for supporting actress.
Right. She would.
Like, there would be no story without Melanie, but it was her feelings for Jared that Wander could not help but experience that... was the acting force on Wanderer. I think the host is definitely worth the read.
Oh, yeah. The only problem I had that was frustrating to me was the whole Seeker thing.
Really?
It was anticlimactic.
No. It was anticlimactic.
Oh, you mean actually the Seeker, the one that was after her.
Yes.
Okay.
I was expecting this.
Spoiler alert, Angela.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, it's okay.
Have you gotten that far?
No, but I'm sure I will.
But it was very disappointing. I really expected this big thing, because he made such an issue of it. She was chasing her the whole time.
I couldn't understand why I was disappointed and dissatisfied with that part. I thought maybe it was just because I didn't like the Seeker. And I also didn't like what they tried to do with her.
I just would have wanted to kick her teeth in. That's all I would.
Seriously, speaking
of our violent nature.
Exactly.
No, I think they should let Melanie out.
Seriously, you just get so sick of her by the end of the book. You're just like, ew, somebody just punch her lights out and just put her out of her misery.
Let Melanie come out and have her.
Yeah, no kidding.
Don't you think so?
But you know, I think that the whole buildup, it was kind of
this big thing, and I was.
Well, and they treated her better than they ever treated Wanderer.
But they explained why they did that.
I know, and it made total sense.
It did make sense.
But weren't you still irritated with it?
I was totally irritated.
I wasn't disappointed with how they treated her. I was disappointed with the fact of what they tried to do with her at the end. That was the thing that was like, you know, oh, let's try and make it all better. I mean, I don't know. I guess that goes into another whole
discussion. Well, don't go into it too much because I don't want to ruin it for Angela.
With other questions.
Because I don't want to ruin that.
Probably a lot of people haven't read it yet, so.
I think there's still a lot of people.
I don't think the stuff we've talked about will not spoil anything.
Yeah,
really.
We'll give away.
It's not going to give it. I mean, the book's what, 500 pages long?
Yeah.
Sheila, what's the number on that page?
619.
619 pages long. I think you're going to be not spoiled. We're not going to be spoiling anything.
Anything we talked about is on the cover. So.
Right, so you already know that.
The only other thing I was a little bit disappointed with was another semi spoiler, was just how Wander ended up at the end physically.
Yeah.
But they chose the body.
I know, but it fit her to me.
But, you know, there's going to be two more, and so I'm interested to see how that...
The Seeker and the Soul.
Interesting. Did she officially come out with that?
She told us that. She said for the next thing she's going to work on...
Well, I knew the next book was going to be the Seeker, because she basically alluded to that in the interview.
Right. Well, and that's what she told us when she talked to us at the book signing. But she told us, she said she's going to take the year off after she finishes all the book tour and everything, and then she's going to work on Edward's version.
I can't wait.
She already has the first 12 chapters written.
12? Already?
We all started cheering.
It's going to be the Seeker, and then what's the third one?
It's the Seeker is the second, and then the Soul is the third.
The Soul, okay.
The Soul.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, but some of the questions were hilarious.
I don't know if I can follow this series, like the host series.
Really?
I enjoyed
for
it.
For two books?
For two, I don't know.
I
can tell you if Twilight went beyond 4 or 5, I'd be done.
And see, I was devastated that there was only one more book left. I think she could have done a lot more with even just 5.
I don't have a problem with series. I have a problem with series that go on and on and on.
Yes.
I like 5 or less.
5 or less? That's exactly where I'm at.
Really? And see, I don't mind. The more, the better.
Oh, we know that. Oh,
my gosh. That's why I like the Left Behind series.
I'm not really into sci-fi. I mean,
Jordan's.
Robert Jordan. Wheel of Time.
If you want something to go on forever, read Robert Jordan.
Well, I'm going to have to just so I can read the last book after Brandon finishes it.
Someone's got to finish.
I mean, my nieces and nephews are there again. My nephews especially, they absolutely love that series.
And they
were jumping up and down when they found out who was going to be writing that last book.
Honestly, until I heard he was writing the rest of book 12, I didn't even know what the Wheel of Time series was.
Well, you just have to hang out with the right crowd.
Come on. But anyway, so that's the host. Like I said, to that one lady in Costco that I saw had it in her car.
I love it.
To the lady at Costco.
I don't know how much that lady is going to enjoy it.
Could you just tell by looking at her?
I'm not sure.
It's a pretty, well, it's not, you can't, I don't think you can put it in one category, really.
You know what? I think it's going to be like this. They're going to be the people who read it, love it, own it, and it stays in their keeper section. There's going to be people who read it, and it's okay, and they read it because it was Stephanie Meyer.
Right, but and
probably
I think,
they're just, they, you know, when it's when it's all about the Twilight and the chemistry, and it wasn't really about the deeper questions, maybe not so much, and they'll borrow it from the library or give it away or,
you know,
something
like
that.
See, I'm going to keep my copy. Don't get me wrong, I'm not getting rid of it. But it's not going to be one that I'm going to pull out on a frequent basis.
I don't think people, I don't think there's going to be the absolutely hate it. I really don't. I think there's people who love it and the ones that are kind of like, nah, it was Stephanie Meyer, so I read it.
Exactly.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
But that's not, how, I don't think there's going to be people who hate it because it's too intriguing. It's too intriguing of a book to hate.
Well,
it may not be your favorite.
But you know what? I liked this book in different reasons, for different reasons.
Me too.
You know, I love Twilight. Because, Edward, you know, give me Edward. You know, I love Edward. You know, okay. But
Angela,
getting
were you
past
Edward
that.
Or Jacob then?
Yeah, please say Edward.
You know what? Actually,
if you say Jacob, I swear.
You need to leave right now.
You know what? Well,
I don't
course,
think so.
I'm
just kidding.
I actually, this is going to sound really funny, but yeah. I actually am more of a fan of the Edward-Jacob relationship than I even am of the romance.
Ooh.
The romance totally reminded me of my first loves, and, you know, and I totally remembered
course,
what
teenager.
It was like to feel like you're going to pass out when they're in the room. And like, I loved all that, and it was fun, but I actually loved the third book, the relationship between Edward and Jacob, as characters more than I even
I
liked Bella. I know quite a few people that
frustrated me.
A lot of people don't like Bella, but I think
I have
Jacob
no feelings either way.
Yeah, I just think they were really fun together. Like, they had stronger personalities to me when they got to face each other in
okay,
the end.
Okay, well,
and
here's
they had dialogue.
Better question. Who is better for Bella?
Oh.
Oh, geez.
Personal opinion.
it really is, but I just want to know what
who
she thinks.
Who is better for a 17-year-old girl growing up, but having college,
really
finding herself?
Yeah, she's really 35.
Right.
Deep inside, she's 35.
you know, am I the only one that's kind of rooting for her not to become...
Yeah. Probably. Well, I want her to get turned instantly.
This is what I was just going to address just okay. with that exactly what you said. Is the world is so dramatic when you're that age and it's all about love and it's all about passion and I kind of look at her relationship with Edward that way, in that it's that incredible passionate young love thing that 20 years down the road that might not be the best thing for you. And so that's kind of how I feel, is I don't know how to answer that question because
well, what about, I mean, when you look at the other end of Jacob, I mean, a lifelong relationship with a werewolf. Who could
Moody werewolf.
Well, and who could imprint with somebody else after you're already
well, he
married.
Hasn't imprinted with Bella. That's the
I
whole
mean,
thing.
I mean, it's just, it's kind of like...
He won't.
Oh, right. I forgot you could imprint, right? Yeah, so well, that totally changes my ass.
See, don't you think so? Don't you think so?
I
there's
know.
No guarantee he would imprint with Bella. And besides, I think Jacob's altogether too pushy.
He is too pushy. Thank you.
I do not like his dirty tricks.
I like
how did we get
mind.
From the host to Twilight? Isn't it just funny? It's just like, instantly, let's go talk about Twilight.
Well, you had to ask about...
I know, I'm sorry.
And then I had to ask which one she liked.
I am
sorry. I wonder
sorry.
How it's going to... Do you guys have
I'm
any ideas on what, how you think it's going to end?
I do, actually, and I've voiced him before. Okay, I really vote for Bella not to become a vampire. However, books have to sell... And so I think that if she doesn't become a vampire, at least at some point,
letter.
There are going to be people who are going to be really upset. Now, there's more than just Bella becoming a vampire or not. There are still the Volturi to deal with.
Ooh, I like
now,
them.
Now, the fact that Bella has mental abilities that block people from affecting her, that will carry over and be emphasized if she were to ever become a vampire. Now, because the Cullens and the Volturi do have to face off at some point.
Which is going to be a fantastic scene.
Which I think that, of course, the werewolves are going to have to
they'll help.
Very likely will have to join in again or still like they did before.
Yep.
But I think that if it came down to a showdown between the Cullens and the Volturi, that Bella would be the determining factor of who will be the victors. But that's just my thought.
Interesting.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Why do you say that?
I'm just wondering because, well, I really don't know this. I could email someone that might know it, though.
Oh, I love it. I love her inside connections. It's so
no,
good.
I really don't know this, but I think she's going to need to do a twist at the end.
Oh, like how
I
twisty.
I mean, everyone's expecting her to end up with Edward or, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if Edward's – I don't know that Edward could become a human or something, but I think something needs to happen so that there's a twist at the end. Because when you build something up that much, you got to, like, do something.
Yeah, excuse
me.
So
that's my thought.
Let's think about Harry Potter 7 and that really crappy epilogue.
Here's the thing.
I'm sorry. I just...
Here's the thing.
Don't change the subject.
That
I know, but that's just kind of the same idea.
Even if Bella were to become the to become a vampire, she still has to get through the young days when she's very hungry and everything. There's going to have to be time. There's going to have to be time for her to be able to gain control of herself
before she gets turned.
You know, that's if she were to become a vampire. But I can tell you that throughout this whole series that I've read so far, there is that whole question of, do you really want to do this? And then even she questions at one point, and especially Edward, says, isn't there anything that you want to do before you become
I'd want to have
vampire?
A baby.
And he has, I know, that's the thing I'm thinking. Like,
that was the main thing I thought about. I wanted her to have a baby.
But that's personal desire for me,
but
too.
But what if she has a baby with and Jacob helps her do that, and then she can have her baby?
Oh, my gosh, Sheila.
Think about who is saying this. I do not like Jacob. I argue with my niece constantly. She loves Jacob. I don't love Jacob because I don't like how he chases Bella.
You know,
it bothers
me. I mean, yes.
But wouldn't that be a twist?
Then what do you do? Do you make that child a vampire later? I mean,
why not? Just, let him grow up and then turn him.
Well, because what if that? I mean, what?
Well,
what a quandary!
Spend 12 years protecting that poor kid.
Well, you'd be working to protect that child from all the other vampires.
Well, we're not
going to
get that far in the storyline, but I'm thinking that would be a major twist.
Well, what if it was a vampire with werewolf powers? Wouldn't that end the war forever?
Ooh, I like that. That would be the thing that would bring them the two groups together.
Because it is kind of a major factor that they're always at war, and Bella's in the middle of them.
You know, it's too bad that this book's already written that we couldn't send off this idea. This would be a great. There's fan fiction out there.
We'll
write
a
fanfic.
We only have 5 weeks till book 4 comes out.
Oh, so I cannot believe it's August 2nd. Yeah, August 2nd.
So it's not going to be that long of a wait. But you know, it's just interesting to see to put our
and
little
wait,
two
is
cents
before
in.
The Edward one?
No.
Oh, no. So is this the end of the story?
It is.
And then we get Edward?
Yeah, Edward's perspective is just like book one from all of his perspective type thing. I'm not sure how much she's going to go.
Have you been on her website? You can read chapter one of Midnight Sun.
Yeah, I knew that was on there.
It is so good.
So it's not supposed
to
like be the
culmination. It won't change it. No, it won't at all.
No. So we're going to find out right away.
But anyway, so now that we've talked about the host night.
Okay, we're done with the host. I want to hear more about what Angela has to say.
I want to listen to Angela.
Lock us out.
Well, are you going to ask me specific questions?
Angela, why don't you start off by telling us kind of how you got into the editing business?
You know what? Basically, we were talking earlier about just loving to read and loving books, and I guess probably from the time I was in first grade, my parents read me The Chronicles of Narnia 7 million times. And I
definitely
was just crazy fan, and from that point on, it was just books, and I was graduating from BYU with an English degree, and I'm like, oh, I don't really have a job, or I'm in English. You know, my dad always said, oh, you'll never get a job with an English degree, right?
I love this.
Except maybe as a teacher.
And so, yeah, and
not
I'm
in Utah, though.
You know, yeah. So I basically was like, oh, I should do something. So I took an editing class, and that was basically my salvation. And then I got a e-commerce tech web editing job or something for a year, and then I started doing manuscript evaluations as freelance for a publisher, and then eventually got a job as an editor with the publisher. And that was like my first experience editing fiction. It was a total luck out. In fact, my uncle, who is a published author, is the one who said, oh, I think there's this publisher at this place. Go send your resume in. I didn't even know about it. And so I totally just kind of lucked out. Because now they didn't have any resources. They have editing minors and all kinds of crazy stuff now, all the universities around here. But back then it was just good luck. But that's basically what happened, and I just lucked out. And I guess if you just really love stories and you read a ton, then you kind of have a sense for how story works. And then the rest of it is just learning the technical marks and the rules and whatever. So, yeah, it's one of the funnest jobs in the world, I do have to say.
I think so.
We're all very jealous.
We are, actually. Yes.
I could read books. I can read a lot of books. I'd love to have a job reading books. That would be fun. But my question
is, isn't that what we're doing
question,
already? We just don't get paid.
I mean, I want to get paid. That's the whole point. I want to get paid for it.
I was just hungry.
But here's the thing. I mean, do you have to read the whole manuscript if you've come across one that's just really bad?
Well, as an editor, like if you're an editor in a publishing house, if a manuscript comes in, like most of them will say, if you don't catch them on the first page, they just shut the book and they're done. In fact, a lot of authors do this little trick of 5 or 6 or 10 pages in, they'll turn a page backwards or something. And if the manuscripts get sent back to them with the rejection letter, they'll go through to see if that page was ever turned over to see how far the editor got.
Good idea.
Oh.
That really is the truth. Most editors will read a page or two, maybe. Some won't give you more than a paragraph.
That's why that catch at the first is very important.
Yeah, the hook is extremely important. Like, the opening of any book is the most important.
I can tell you, I've read some where there was no hook.
Right.
I know.
I didn't know how they managed to get published.
And the problem with that is that in the bookstore, then, on the marketing end, the reader feels the same way. I think it's something like you have 18 seconds to sell a book in a bookstore, which between picking up the book, looking at the cover, looking at the back liner, and reading the first page, the book is sold or history at that point. And so it's actually...
I think that's totally true. I've done that.
It is true. I mean,
absolutely.
The cover grabs you first, which everyone says don't judge a book by its cover, but
not true.
Who doesn't?
I totally do.
In fact, they even have, like, at the Chicago publishing conferences and stuff, they have classes on how to make the spine of your book more enticing.
Seriously.
Because so many books are just spine out at the bookstore. So really it is about just first impressions, and that's really a big part of selling it. Unless you get some sort of word of mouth going, and that's
totally
different.
Well, and it all starts
thing.
With that first impression you make on the editor.
Right. Or the agent,
or
generally
the agent,
speaking, depending
first.
On how it's going through.
Now, I know we have a lot of listeners that maybe are thinking about writing books, or maybe in the future, like Shanda and Sheila and I always talk about later on kind of a thing. What's the first step as an editor, from an editor's perspective, should a new author perhaps take? What's the first step to go with? Besides writing it.
Should they just go ahead and start writing it, or should they approach writing with a game plan?
You know, everyone does it differently, but I'm a big fan of becoming educated about the fields. I mean, you wouldn't go try to become a doctor without training. You know what I mean? You wouldn't try to go become this. Some people luck out and are really talented. There are people with natural talent.
Thank
Do you know
goodness.
What I mean?
Amen.
Most professional fields, if you want to be successful, you really need to learn how the business works.
Well, wouldn't someone who does have what you would call natural talent still need a little bit of refining?
Oh, everybody needs refining. In fact...
So it wouldn't hurt at all to take some classes?
No.
No matter who you are.
Everyone should be reading... Like, for example, if you want to write fantasy, you should be studying all the great fantasy authors to see what they're doing. Basically, as an editor, what you're doing is taking all that knowledge about everything you've read and applying it to comparing it to the thing that you're reading. And depending on how the thing that you're reading matches up, you either have to try to apply those same techniques of good writing to make it more marketable, or you just look at it and think it's hopeless and you let it go its way. So everyone needs to absolutely be studying their craft no matter what, and you should also be studying the business so that if you get your lucky break, you have half a clue what you're doing, because you can be the most talented writer in the world and your book will never sell to more than 20 people because you didn't know how to be involved in marketing, how publishing works, how to get it out there, because it's all about distribution.
That's true. You can't make any money if you're not getting it out there.
Right. So you're either writing for yourself, self-publishing for fun, or...
Okay, so in the LDS market versus the general market, how much more marketing do LDS authors do versus what a general public author?
You know what? It's actually probably supposed to be around the same. Your market is a little bit smaller, but even big national publishers want you to do all the same kind of really heavy grassroots, be involved. In fact, there's all kinds
like
of, you know.
Like email campaigns or like what kinds of things?
Everybody needs to have blogs. Everybody needs to have blogs. They need to have websites. They need to be doing tours and book clubs and grassroots and getting out there. And there's, you know, guerrilla marketing for books and 1,001 ways to market your book and
there
Writer's
are also
Digest.
Podcasts.
No, it's not just about the time invested that it takes to write the book.
Oh, absolutely.
And edit the book or rewrite the book and then get it published. And then get it out there. But then you also have the time invested in footwork, mm-hmm. getting out there before you even get
oh, yeah.
your check.
Oh, yeah.
You
absolutely.
Really have to be dedicated to your craft to be able to really do that. I think you can tell the authors that are willing to do that, too.
Oh, you can absolutely tell the authors. And in fact, like I was saying, with knowing your craft and knowing your business, if you approach a publisher with having researched the market and having a marketing plan and being excited and having all these ideas, they're 1,000 times more willing to work with you and be excited to work with you than if you don't. Because almost anybody in a publishing business is overworked, underpaid, super busy, and nobody gets to be a prima donna when they first walk in. And so we have all kinds of authors all the time who, why aren't you marketing my book? Well, the publisher just spent $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 paying for your edit, paying for your cover, paying for distribution, paying to get it in all the catalogs, all the advertising. And they are now onto the next 200 books in the line that they need to keep getting out and marketing and whatever else. And they're not going to spend a ton of time just holding your hand and helping you sell your book unless you're willing to put a lot of work in.
Well, everybody appreciates something that makes their job easier. So if Absolutely. You as an author can step in and make the editor or an agent's job a little easier, I bet you'll be just that much more successful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it makes sense.
Absolutely makes sense.
Okay, what else is on the list of things that an author would need to do? You mentioned before, you know, getting an agent.
Would a new author need an agent? Would you recommend that just before to protect even sending them? It to an editor? Or?
Well, it's different in the LDS market versus the national market. LDS market, they generally don't do a lot with agents. Because the market's small enough, and
would they just send their book to everybody, like all the publishers?
You can send your book to everybody. It's courtesy to write multiple submission to put in your cover letter that it's a multiple submission, so they know that.
Oh, that way they're not thinking you're the only one.
Okay. They generally don't prefer you to be sending them out to lots because they're spending money reviewing your work. But there's no law against it. I mean, if you have something really good, publishers do have bidding wars. Well, so
frankly, if I wrote something that I thought was at least decent, I'd be wanting to give it every chance.
I mean, yeah.
Or send it to one, and then if you get rejected by them, send it to the other one, and then if you get rejected by them, send it to the other one.
You want to send it to who you think is going to give you the best shot at having distribution and having people find your book. For example, authors will send it to several publishers, and they'll have a publisher that may be smaller, maybe not have the same kind of manpower, the same kind of budget, the same kind of marketing except the book. But then they're waiting to hear from the publisher that they really, really want. But then they're under pressure to say yes or no to the other publisher. And so that is the one problem you do have to deal with is...
With multiple submissions.
Because, like, for instance, at a smaller house, which may or may not do a good job for you, they might have a very small submission pile compared to a bigger house that has hundreds and hundreds sitting in a pile waiting to be looked at. And so you could be sitting there trying to decide on the smaller publisher when they're still 50 manuscripts away from even looking at your book, and they will not pick it up and speed it up for you. Now, so you could lose that opportunity.
That's kind of a quandary for an author to be in because you want to get accepted as soon as possible and get paid for the work that you've done and see if you can even get published. But you have to wait longer with the big guys. But if the big guys publish your book, you have a better chance of success.
I think strategy is far more important than speed in terms of publishing.
I'm learning that with how long it takes just to even get the book and then to get it published. You know, the months and months you have to wait.
Yeah, give our listeners kind of an idea of how that works, just without...
Well, it could take anything from a couple months to years. I was at a writing conference the other day, and some really big-name authors have had books sitting, accepted by their publishers, waiting to be put out for years. Because most publishers are 1 to 2 to 3 years out in their line already. And so they're working on stuff that's way down the line that's already scheduled and already, because they have to put it in all kinds of catalogs and magazines and
Well, once it's accepted, there's still no guarantee it will ever be published. Right?
There isn't a guarantee. I think the publishers usually in the contract have a certain period of days and within which they have to respond or deal with it or do something with it. But sometimes those are really long periods of time. If you get an agent, like with the national market, agents help you negotiate and manage all these things, and they help you find the best publisher. Like if you have multiple, they'll shop it to a few publishers. If there's a bidding war, they'll help you figure out which one is the best publisher for you in terms of personality fit, advance or not advance, long term, like all the deals in your contract. So, like I said, it's really important to know the business, to understand how it works, to know how marketing works, because actually being a writer is more about marketing now than it is writing almost.
Oh, that's almost sad.
Yeah, it's incredible, but it really is. It's about marketing now.
Well, that's kind of how almost everything is, though.
It's true. It's really true. But you think about, you know, the craft is the writing part, but you have to be just as knowledgeable about how to get your book out there as well as just learning, knowing how to write the book.
Well, and it's a shame to think of how, I mean, that sounds like an intimidating process to me. And it's kind of a shame to think that there's some good stories out there that may never see the light of day.
Because of that.
Yeah. It is. And the reality is that you need to take it as a serious career. Like a lot of people just think, oh, I'll write my book. But if you actually are successful, you are so busy with that new writing career that you have to sometimes make choices between family time versus marketing your book time, or dropping your other career versus marketing your book. I mean, it's not just a casual, oh yay, I'll turn my book in. I mean, that's fine if you want to sell 1,000 copies and nobody heard of it and that's great. But if you're serious about it, it's actually a big career decision.
Everybody needs to watch Cheaper by the Dozen.
Oh, when she wrote her book, totally. She didn't want to leave her family and... But not all of us have 12 kids at home either.
That's, you know what? That's what exactly what I was thinking about Stephanie Meyer. Because I'm like that, you know, she's wrote these books and never intended it to take off like it did. But now she has, and she has 3 young sons and possibly one on the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just how much time is she spending outside the country, away from her family? How much can her family come with her? I mean, you have to sacrifice that. When we were at Good Things Utah watching her, and I was realizing just how much travel and how many interviews and how far away from home for how long, and I just didn't know if I could do that.
Well, and she had just gotten back from a tour, you know, in Europe. Mm-hmm. She'd been there for a month or so, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how fun to go to Europe, but...
But how much of it did she get to do?
Take her family with her?
I don't know.
Maybe just her husband. I mean, if her kids are in school, I mean...
Well, she's paid enough.
A lot of parents...
You could have her tutor come with you with your kids.
I know, but, you know, that would be hard. Because me personally, I'm a very private person. I don't really want all my junk out there, you know?
Well, the thing that I was just wondering about... What do you see as the newest trend? I know you said, you know, how someone writes a book like Harry Potter and then, you know, everything, all the different Harry Potter type books.
Right.
And then Stephanie Meyer wrote Twilight, and then we saw all the vampire wannabe Twilight books or wannabe Harry Potter books. So what do you think is, I mean...
Or what would you like to see, I guess? Like, you personally, like, what kind of... I don't know.
But I'm just curious if she's seen something that's...
Well, what
that's
can you what? Answer?
The way that works, that's kind of a hard... Okay. All the different editors and agents and everything in New York all have, you know, blogs or whatever they do. And they're told to go out and find a new YA series or something. And so you could look on, like, Publishers Weekly or Publishers Lunch or, you know, maybe Writer's Digest or the different blogs of the new up-and-coming editors and agents and whatnot. And they'll kind of be talking about things. And so you can kind of get a sense. I mean, no one's going to come out and say, here's our new secret weapon that we're going to take over the world with financially. And you'll get an idea of what people are interested in or what's going on. I mean, the trends, publishers, if they knew how to make all the big money, they'd all be doing exactly what they should. They're all trying to find the next big thing that will take off. And that's why, you know, Hemingway was rejected 21 times.
Oh, that's so sad.
Harry Potter was rejected, you know.
That's true. She had her own.
It's about who, really, that's the thing, is if an editor loves it, then it'll get to that next step, and then hopefully the audience will love it. And that's the thing with, you just never know what the next big trend is going to be, because everyone is looking for that next big trend.
So what, in your experience, has been the ratio for, in your reading, say you get 10 manuscripts... Just random manuscripts, pulling them off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those 10 will probably make it through?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Oh, they're really low.
Just in your experience, is there 1 in 10, or is it more like 1 in 20, or like, more like 1 in 100?
It is probably less than 1 in 20, and it's probably less than 1 in 100. I know that, I mean, look at publishers publish, what, 100 books a year? You know what I mean? Like, look at what a publisher's line is, and then imagine the 10 or 20,000 people that try to send stuff in.
There's so many books.
You know what I mean? I mean, think about, I think Barnes & Noble, last year or something, gets like 18,000 new books a month or something crazy.
A month?
Yeah. And those are books that are accepted, published.
National.
Yeah.
Still, that's...
But it's kind of the same. The ratio is still super big between all the people who want to write books and the people who actually get published. So it's a huge...
So in your opinion... Do you think that this big trend on all these super books for young adult readers, is it going to continue? I hope it does.
You know,
I think fabulous.
I was just talking with someone that young adult and middle grade is far outselling, like fantasy type stuff, that young adult and middle grade is far outselling in terms of numbers adult fantasy and sci-fi. That's what I understand. So I think it actually has become a big... And I think, you know, part of it's that so many kids started reading again with Harry Potter or whatever.
Yes, they did. And as a teacher, I saw this happening.
I think that's great. But there's a part of me that as I look through, I can see some oversaturation.
Oh, every market.
But you know what? But let me tell you the difference between nowadays versus 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, moms and dads were not reading the same books as their kids. They were not.
That's true.
Nowadays, moms like me, I'm loving the books that my kids are reading. that this is the difference between 10 years ago and 20 years ago.
I think that's
as that the writers are not writing just for the age group between 10 and 15.
Disney's not making movies just for kids anymore.
Well, no,
either.
They are secretly writing this in hopes that they can grab an adult audience. You know,
exactly.
So that, I think that, don't you think that's the kind of a difference that they're right? They know that there are going to be these adults that are going to be reading these now.
Right. But I'm thinking
it expands your market.
Okay. Now, Angela, here's a question for you, just in your opinion. At what books or series of books do you think actually totally opened up a new idea to what was out there for LDS writing?
Dave Farland's Of Mice and Magic.
Really?
Did he go under Wolverton or Farland for that? Was it under Farland?
I can't remember. I haven't read those ones, even though I would like to.
That was one of the first ones that came out.
Of Mice and what?
Of Mice and Magic.
And he keeps having lots of books come out quite
consistently. Is that a young adult?
Probably middle grade. But there wasn't a lot of fantasy, LDS fantasy for kids. And then Mice and Magic came out. And then all the, if I recall, then all the, and this was kind of around the Harry Potter time, but all of a sudden Deseret Book did a whole bunch of children fantasy. Covenant did a whole bunch of children fantasy. That was one of the first big children fantasy, because fantasy is still something that has not been really big in the LDS market. And the problem is, one of the problems is that it's not a niche. Like, lots and lots of Mormons read fantasy, but you can get, and science fiction, and you can get all of that at the normal bookstore. And they usually turn to the LDS stuff for the clean romance or the clean adventure or the clean whatever. And so the niche market was in these alternative clean safe products. But with fantasy and science fiction, you don't need an LDS version because it's usually speculative or something else. You know what I mean? It's not this genre that has standard things that go into it.
Makes sense.
And so that was one of the first big kind of fantasy ones that started up in LDS. And the other problem with that is it's a hard genre to figure out how to do in LDS because...
Well, don't you have the whole witchcraft
question? You do. I mean, that's the whole problem. It's all about magic, yet where does God fit into the magic? You know what I mean? So it's a hard genre to even create for that market.
Okay,
you know,
so that
to market and in the LDS market, it's a totally different thing.
Well, and there's a very, very, different wide range of readers in the LDS market too, and that's especially with publishing houses that kind of work under the jurisdiction of the church.
Oh,
you have to be really careful about what you're putting in books for young readers and what you're suggesting and not suggesting, even subtly. You know, like YA, for example, is another one that's really hard to do effectively, in the sense that YA is supposed to be all about pushing boundaries and finding yourself. And
yes,
and you don't really want to be encouraging teenagers to push boundaries in LDS fiction. And so there are genres that actually create problems in terms of being created by that particular group of publishing houses. And they mostly stick to the more didactic YA. And now they're going with the adventure. Now that we have the fantasy opened up, we can kind of go with the adventure route with light morals and whatever. All that was really there before was kind of a lot of didactic. It's all about having attention.
I have no idea what that word means.
Oh, sorry. Just like preachy.
I was just nodding.
Just preachy. Like, it's all about morals, and, you know, the moral of this whole story is about being modest. You know, a lot of teenagers, like, some of them want to start about being modest, but most of them don't because they hear it all day at church, you know?
Exactly.
And that's kind of the problem, is we don't want to write stories encouraging them to explore themselves and have boundaries and whatever else.
Even though they're going to do it anyhow.
Explore those boundaries.
But why give them permission?
Right.
I guess that's
well, for example, a lot of LDS moms or writers have problems with, like, the Stephanie Meyer books for YA because the young girl in there is trying to get Edward to
compromise,
be naughty, you know? And that is, it's selling humongously and everyone loves it, but that's a problem that a lot of parents have, is they don't want to have the heroine of the novel want to do something bad. From a marketing standpoint, originally, the idea behind LDS stuff was that it would be so safe you wouldn't have to worry about it. Because that's kind of, you know, the problem is parents need to monitor everything and watch everything. And so when it was all first coming out, the idea was that anything you buy in that store will be totally safe for anyone in your family to read. You don't have to worry about it. And that's kind of why it hasn't broken into certain genres, like the horror genre and whatnot. Like, they're exploring those boundaries now, but it's when you have limits, it's a lot harder to explore what you will and won't have in that, because you don't, like, I've seen parents write in letters because in a book, a bad guy was drinking Jack Daniels.
Are you serious? On a literary aspect, I have a hard time believing a bad guy who doesn't have something wrong with them, whether it be drinking, whether it be smoking, whether it be like Dorothy Kennington. I remember when I first started reading her, she had a few cuss words in there, and I just went, oh, my goodness, oh no. And I thought, and then as I've gotten older, I've thought about it and gone, this is really clean for a bad guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can watch, name a show, any show on TV, and I guarantee you, you will hear swearing from the bad guys, and usually from the good guys too, but from the bad guys especially. It's just like, okay, I'm a big time hockey fan, which I have never been quiet about. Miracle, love the movie, but I have never heard such clean language from hockey players in my entire life.
I know, it's a great
show. They
don't
talk like that, in case anyone is wondering. They don't. That's not how they talk.
They lisp through their broken teeth with their swear words.
Yes, it's all lisping. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, sound so, like my son no, right now. Just, he's losing all his teeth.
I mean, you have to be realistic. But, I mean, I know there's pushing the envelope and maybe taking it too far. And I can understand that you'd want to avoid that.
I have a question for Angela. Okay. With covers, how we've heard from both Rob and Jeff and Michelle that they don't really get a say on their covers. So how does that work necessarily in the publishing end of it?
That's actually pretty standard industry standard. The covers are usually determined by a combination of, for example, the art director and the designers will come up with several different comps. Those comps will be run around to marketing people, to bookstore owners, to all kinds of different people who assess it based on how marketable it is and how well they could sell it.
Wait, so it's not even based on, they don't have any, like the people that they send it to don't even have a clue what the book's about.
No, I mean, they might be given a backliner and a hook, you know, so they'll be told the basic plot or something. But like I was saying earlier with how you have 18 seconds to sell a book in the store, nobody in the store is going, this book cover doesn't look anything like the backliner. I don't think I want it. They're just captured by the image. And so that's kind of more what the cover is about is, I mean, there's a lot of covers that don't even have anything to do with what's in the book, like, which is annoying to, you know, editors and authors, but it's all about marketing. It's not about what the story is about.
So then the people in marketing art, whatever, that design the covers, did they read the book?
It totally also, again, depends on the publishing house, how much time they have. Ideally, anyone who works on the project should be able to read the book. But time-wise, it's not realistic that anyone's always going to read a full book. So most people will have read some summary chapters, some, you know, the author's blurb about it. They'll have discussed with the editor what the book's about. And so they'll be trying to create a marketing hook based on all of those things, what's most marketable about the book. And then they will try to put in the cover image also what is most marketable so they can sell it.
Okay, now going along with this idea, what you said about the cover, like in Fablehaven, there are pictures here and there. Who chooses those pictures? Is it the same department that chooses the cover, or is it actually the Brandon Mole was the one that got to choose which pictures were illustrated and put into his book?
You know, I can't speak for that exact book, but that actually is a little different. Internal art sometimes is the design department. It is sometimes the author brings it in. Like, for example, a lot of times, like really nice maps or something that are on end sheets, a lot of those are brought in by the authors. Or the publisher will hire an artist to do them. Same thing with the inner art. Normally, you know, authors don't bring an artist with them, but sometimes they will have a really good product that also works. So that's kind of more back and forth, depending on the publisher.
What about a children's picture book? How is an author? Because that's the one I'm curious about.
That's definitely how a publisher do they decision.
What if it's something, because in my mind's eye, the story that I've been working on all these years, I have an idea of what kind of pictures I would mm-hmm. like. I want them more realistic looking, not cartoony looking, because it's a story about my grandmother.
Right.
And I want to actually bring my picture and my grandmother's picture and say, have someone kind of paint these pictures. That type
you mean
of book.
Like, kind would like a that watercolor be, or oil? Well, kind of look, just, or like,
I envision it dreamy, kind of like the
exactly
the
right. But it's still it's more of a painting. It's not mm-hmm. cartoonish whatsoever. But how much say does a children's author actually have in that?
You know what? You really don't. You will have an opportunity to give that feedback. But for example, a lot of children's book authors will come with their best friend artist and say, we want to sell this together. And a publisher rarely ever takes the artist and the author because
really?
It's, again, it's hugely about marketing. And the editor will read that book and think, because they have the same as with covers, they have a whole slew of very famous or really talented artists that are already having a name in that field or already have a name for other books. And they will think, this book is great. It is very marketable if we put so-and-so's art in it. Oh. So you will be allowed to show what you want and talk about it, but right. you really, if you want to get published, you really need to be willing to compromise and work with how the publisher thinks they will be able to market your idea.
Interesting.
Because it's once you hand it over to them, it's all their money producing that thing.
That's
and getting
true.
It out
so
there.
You really don't have a lot
so
of
So you
say,
might have though. A little bit of feedback,
but not a lot.
Will they go with the feel of the book? If it feels more cartoony, they'll go
with
the cartoony.
They'll go with whatever. Yeah, they'll go with whatever. I mean, you know, the better the publisher, they'll go right. with something that they think fits the tone and is beautiful. I mean, they want
I
a beautiful product.
Right.
Either way, that will help sell it. But they may, I mean, for example, I was just at a conference and the editor there who had just taken on a beautiful children's book, the author had come in with their own artist. They knew what they wanted it to look like. They thought it would have people. And the publisher was envisioning animals oh. and cartoons and a whole bunch of different stuff. And the book would not have seen the light of day if the author had not been willing to compromise and let them do the project the way they
That's
wanted to do
it. That's a huge compromise, though.
Huge compromise.
Had that book been marketed yeah. already?
Is it now?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's popular. It's really done well. It's okay. a beautiful
what's,
book.
What's the
so
book?
They
I'm
trusted
curious.
The publisher and it went and it did well.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah. I'm curious.
It's something the giant hug or the big hug or the oh, something hug. I don't okay. remember. It's a really cute idea. But and I don't know all the details of you know what the author had brought in or didn't, but I know that it changed a lot in conception to publication.
Because I mean, I love Jan Brett's illustrations. I love her mm-hmm. type of work versus I mean, I love Eric Carle, but it would make me cry to have that type of thing versus the other thing. I want more realistic.
Well, something you know? You could try to do is, and this is what all authors should be doing, is go find the art and the artists that you like that think would do a good job on your thing and go see what publisher they do a lot of work with. They may be all over the place, but they may also do a ton of stuff with Simon & Schuster or yeah. something. So just go find out where that stuff is done, and then go see if that publisher might be a good fit for you because they
right.
obviously
do
have a relationship.
Yeah. Research.
That's
yes.
a good idea. I didn't think about kind of going out about it backwards that
no,
way.
No, I like, hadn't either, but that is know. A smart idea.
But it is a smart idea, especially if, you know, if your match really is a good match with the story, and I think with your background that you'd already have a feel of what works with your
right.
children's story.
Right.
And then it's just, you know, luck. I mean, if you have that in mind and then you go find agents that work a lot with that publisher mm-hmm. and one of those agents likes your story, you know what I mean?
Right.
There are ways you can try to have greater influence, but you just have to be aware of how the game works.
Boy, it's yeah, a tricky game. The more the more you talk tonight, it's like, wow, this is a very tricky business.
But you know what? More if so. Anyone can pull it off, I think you can.
No, I don't know. But thank you for your confidence. It's like, thank you.
You want to read it.
We're going to see it in print one day. I know it.
I hope so. Because, you know, it's always one of those things. I don't know if a lot of writers are like this, but you always think, what's that one thing you want to do before you die? Mm-hmm. And mine was always to have a children's book published.
Right.
I don't know. It's just because I've been reading them for so many years as a teacher. But, you know, and you read hundreds and hundreds, up to 1,000. I mean, you get to that point where you've just been reading them so often and so, you know, that you just think, you know, I think I know what people like and what kids like and what would be interesting. And so that's my dream.
Right.
But we'll see.
Well, thanks to Angela's input. I think you're
it's
a little
true.
Bit closer.
Have you get
that's
it?
That would be fun.
Okay. No. So any other questions or
I just want to know if there's something that she felt would be interesting for our listeners. As you were like pulling your notes together and everything, is there something that you think that you really wanted to let our listeners know?
Well, just I guess in terms of readers, I just think one of the best things I could ever say is just expand your horizons. Some of my greatest experiences of opening my mind to other people's ways of thinking or my own, you know, like my own closed-mindedness or other worlds outside of mine or just things that are so beautiful that I didn't even know anything about. Almost the vast majority of those experiences have been through reading. Historical books about other countries, other people, especially books that are set outside of your experience. It's wonderful to read. I read lots of nonfiction self-help too, just to see people that are going through my same experience and how they got through it. And that's helpful, but it's also wonderful to see outside your world. I mean, I've been brought to tears over books of experiences of people in these books that I would never in a million years feel, experience, you know, the loss of a child, that, you know, just so many experiences that I may never have that give you empathy for other people and just, you know, more interest in the world and more passion about the world. And, in fact, I married my husband over a book that he liked.
Serious.
So he lucked out.
Yeah. Look at him.
Yeah. If anyone wants to try something really literary and heavy, but beautiful, try Wallace Stegner. Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner or Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. He is one of the most talented, beautiful writers. It's heavy stuff. It's kind of hard to get through at first, depending on what your reading interests are. But I read Crossing to Safety and put it down, and I thought, if this guy I'm dating loves this book, I need to marry this guy.
I love it. So, wow. That is wonderful.
That, I would say, is the biggest thing I can say to readers. And for authors, really, again, do your research. If you're really serious about becoming an author, so honestly, if you want to impress an editor or an agent or a publisher, do your research. Know about the industry. Know about that publisher. Know about the agent. Know what they like. Know what genre you're writing for. I mean, nothing's more annoying as a publisher to, like, be a publisher of nature magazines and to get novel submissions. You know, I mean, that happens all the time. And it automatically labels you as being a non-professional. And people don't want to work with a non-professional. If you want to be serious about getting into it, do your research.
Could you give our listeners some information about, we've talked about the Storymakers Conference, but besides that, are there other opportunities?
Oh, there are millions.
Are they just here in Salt Lake?
Is there maybe a website they can go to see that? Or what are other websites they can check? Does it come up on are they hosted by publishing companies?
You know what? There are tons. But you could Google writing conferences or something. There are just in the last year, there are 5 or 6 for sci-fi and fantasy, either in Salt Lake or close to Salt Lake.
Oh, and speaking of, actually, Shannon Hale is actually participating in one on July 19th.
And I really want to go to this.
For, is it Kids in Wheelchairs or something like that? It's a charity, something like that, where you can, they're going to have multiple authors, children's authors from, I'm not sure exactly where they're all from, but and other authors where you, for I think it's like $45 that's tax deductible, you can bring up to 300 words of your book, you know the first part of your book, whatever, and get feedback from these authors. You have to bring a certain number of copies. I think it's like 12 copies of your, so you can get it submitted and you can speak with them and get feedback. And all of this information in Salt Lake, if you are in the Salt Lake area or Utah area, go to... Oh, where did I see
that? Wasn't that James Dashner's website?
Actually, I think I did see that on James Dashner's blog. So jamesdashner.blogspot.com. But I'm sure you might be able to find it other places, especially on Shannon Hale's website. I'm sure it's on hers. That's another writing conference that's soon that I heard about.
So. You guys have a website, right?
We do.
LDS Women's Book
Review. I actually have I taught a class on publishing one night up at Weber State, and I had to compile a big, huge document with tons of websites listed for writers' conferences and writers' resources and stuff. So I can just send you guys that. And
sweet.
We would love that.
Love it. That'd be a good resource.
But yeah, I mean, basically, Writer's Market, get a subscription or get the free newsletters on email from Writer's Digest. And
be prepared to go all the way.
Yeah, and be prepared, you know what you want to do and don't want to do and what your limits are. And, you know, and then just work hard and be patient, because sometimes you can, I think Jessica Day George, 8 or 9 years trying to get published before she had her breakthrough.
See, that is amazing.
So don't just be like, oh, I'm giving up the end, you know? Or don't be like, I'm doing this no matter what at the expense of your entire life. Just
that's true.
Decide how much you care and just be willing to be patiently work for it, because you never know when it'll happen.
If you've got that story in you,
do it.
And you want to tell it, go for it.
You know, that's what was so exciting about being at the Whitney Awards. There were all these people, you know, a lot of them didn't have their book published yet, but they had this story out there. There was just this electricity that was in that room as we were going around talking to all these people. I mean, it was fun talking to all the real established people, but it was also just fun talking to those that weren't.
Well, that reminds me of a question I was going to ask earlier. Do you, when we were talking about Michelle Page Holmes and Counting Stars, I mean, it was great that she was the first author to ever win a Whitney Award. She was the first category.
Exciting.
Yeah. You know, and it was wonderful that she was able to win that. So do you think that winning an award like that is something that would help her further her career as an author?
In terms of reader interest or in terms of name recognition?
Well, I'm sure that name recognition would help a little bit, especially in the industry. But if they were to put a Whitney Award winner sticker on her book at a bookstore, would that
You know, those kinds of readers? Things can always help. Again, it's the same thing with publishers trying to just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks and see what people like. The more and more something is heard of, for example, the New York Times bestseller list, as soon as that sticker's on the front of a book, people just automatically think, oh, this is probably good. So as long as a award becomes more and more known or whatnot, then that will ring as familiar in people's ears. So that's, I mean, it's never going to hurt to show that something won an award, ever. That could always help marketing. But yeah, definitely as it gets bigger and bigger, more people will recognize it. And, you know, maybe book clubs could be started on Whitney Award books or something like that.
I think that's a great idea. I think within 5 years, I think it'll be a bigger difference. Don't you think so? Because, I mean, I know all of us, or at least I was, just running around going, oh, the Whitney Awards, and talking mm-hmm. about it, sending people to the website, and, right. you know, just to see what had happened and telling them about the books that had won. But I sent Rob an email about a month and a half ago just asking him, okay, I was there, you know, at Siegel Book, and I was going past all the books that had won awards, and there was nothing that showed they had won an award. And I thought, something needs to happen with, you know.
Weren't they trying to get stickers?
Yeah, I think he said that they had. I know that Rob said they had a template that they gave to the authors if they wanted to copy, print them off, and
right.
use on their own, that said Whitney Award winner.
Right. Know. So they probably are trying. I'm sure it's the same thing of publishers being so overburdened with everything they're doing anyway. Well, but
can we know how we feel about the Whitney Awards from a reader standpoint, and from someone who is at the, you know, with the podcast level, we are meeting with some of the authors and just being excited about the whole thing. But from an industry, you know, behind the scenes viewpoint, is the Whitney Awards something that is it seen in a positive light? I mean, what is the feeling?
Ooh, great question.
You know, from that side of the curtain, I guess you could say.
Right. Well, I can't speak for anyone that's in house right now, but obviously, if I recall seeing several people from Covenant and Deseret Book and a whole bunch of publishers were there at the awards. So I would assume that the publishers are all supporting it. They're excited about it. Anything that is going to help sell a book to a publisher, they're going to be in favor of.
You would think
that's
that
what I was
love
thinking.
It.
But, yeah. I mean, that's what I figured.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're supportive and excited about it.
What bothered me, like 2 weeks before the awards, I went into Deseret Book and I was asking the clerks. I'm like, oh, you know, this one's nominated for a Whitney Award. And the guy's like, what are you talking about?
Right. I know. They
like,
all,
I was crazy. And I'm
know.
Like, oh, well, this is, you know, LDS.
They're in the bookstores.
Explaining it. I'm like, right. You work in a bookstore.
Right.
Well, and he
you
was
really
eligible.
Need to learn what this is about.
And he was eligible to vote. That was the other thing.
Right.
As an employee.
So it definitely needs to get.
But it's only in
its
first
year
or two.
Right. It just needs to be built up. And, you know, the more the people, I mean, if people go in asking to bookstores, do you have anything from the Whitney Awards? You can guarantee that salespeople will suddenly start figuring out what that is. You know,
I hope so
it's the same thing. The market's driven
that's
by interest.
That's what we need to do.
Exactly.
We need to email to all of our friends and family and say, okay. Next time you're in the bookstore,
we're going on a blitz campaign.
Right.
Ask about Whitney Award
exactly.
nominees and Whitney Award winners.
Right.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Market interest drives new markets. So,
is there anything you guys want to finish up with? I mean, before we have to say goodbye.
I think we're pretty well covered. I thought it was very informative.
We'll have you back on the podcast sometime.
That'd be great.
It has been so
it.
Great
been
chatting
fun.
With
awesome.
You.
That'd be great. I'd love to.
Thanks so much for coming to visit.
Thank you.
I'm kind of sad that it's over.
It's really fun.
But it's been great, and we hope that you listeners have enjoyed this podcast as much as we have. Next podcast, we're hoping Jessica Day George will still be coming and nothing's changed because we can't wait to speak with her. It's going to be great having these wonderful women on our podcast so close together. So join us for episode 26 when hopefully Jessica will be able to be joining us. Thanks for joining us for episode 25, and we'll catch you next time.
See Bye.
Ya. Bye.